Knobloch versus, excuse me, Mr. Pascoe versus Knobloch. Mr. Sala?
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Tommy Seiler, and I, alone, my colleague Brett Harvey, represent the defendant in this case. Mr. Wade, the plaintiff's counsel, and I were principally responsible for creating this mess, and so we're both here today to, I assume, to answer for our transgressions and try to get this straightened out.
Answer you will.
Mr. Wade and I have been trying cases against each other, we were talking about it a moment ago, for 25 years, and tried these kind of cases frequently. Probably over the years filed 100 or close to 100 qualified immunity motions in these kinds of cases, and Mr. Wade's probably dealt with more than that. And I think this marks the third pretrial qualified immunity motion I've ever appealed during all that time. And the last two I did were back in the 1980s, and I lost both of them, never tried it again. So it's really a rare instance that that we appear before the court on a pretrial qualified immunity motion. That being said, I know Your Honors have read these briefs and know basically what the cases are about. There's a bit of a procedural quagmire, obviously, that has gone on because of how these cases came about. But the principal issue here, in my view, is whether or not Scott v. Harris is going to control, and the court's going to find that there was no Fourth Amendment violation, or more importantly, that their qualified immunity was applicable, and the defendant should have been dismissed.
Well, the district judge first said that she was not going to hear about qualified immunity because you hadn't timely raised it. You raised it, but you hadn't done it timely, she said. And then she said, I gather she went on and said, but even if you had, it wouldn't have done you any good because this Scott case, it was different or something of that nature.
I think principally she believed it was different, because it came after the fact, some several years after the fact of the incident that led to the plaintiff's decedent's passing. But also, I think she had some different issues with it. Principally, that the officer involved, if you accept the plaintiff's view of the facts, which we must here, disobeyed his commanding officer's order to cease the chase. And I think that was the court's, as I understand the opinion, that was the court's main issue on the substantive Fourth Amendment issue. And we've briefed that extensively, but the bottom line to it is that the courts, including the United States Supreme Court and Scott v. Harris itself, said that the failure to follow instructions or policies of the police officer's particular venue does not have any Fourth Amendment implications and shouldn't affect qualified immunity.
Well, it is a little bit different, though, it seems to me. It's not – this man just didn't simply fail to follow policy or something, which I suppose some officers may be sufficiently ignorant not to really realize that particular policy. But here's the man, he just disobeyed a direct order. At least there's some evidence of that. I think he said he didn't.
That's correct. Our officers always said that he wasn't even close to the vehicle at the time it went off the road, that he had ceased his pursuit by that point.
But did he admit that he got an order not to pursue and pursued anyway? I thought he had, but maybe not.
Well, no, there is no question because there we have the dispatch tapes, is my recollection. Dispatch tapes clearly show that his commanding officer said to cease the pursuit, and the officer at that juncture, according to his testimony, stopped the pursuit. So there's no question. It's only when you get to the plaintiff's theory of the case where they say he did not cease the pursuit and continued that we have the problem. Now, same thing happened to Scott v. Harris. The officer was told he could given instructions to attempt a pit maneuver. And instead of attempting that maneuver, which is not nearly as invasive or much of a seizure, I suspect the best way to say it, he rammed him.
Not as dangerous.
Not as dangerous. He rammed him with his push bumper on his car and pushed him off the road. So
I guess all I'm saying is that, and it does seem to me, the officer in that in the Scott case told him, you know, go ahead and give him a pit or whatever it is, and he went ahead and did him a bump instead. Now that it, it, by that, that that's the bump's more dangerous and so forth. But the man didn't tell him, don't just look, be sure and I just give him a pit. Don't want nothing else. Maybe that's a small difference.
And in my view, it would be. But the point is, the officer there was told to do something. He did something else. Supreme Court expressly reviewed that and said even if he disobeyed the orders, it still didn't have Fourth Amendment.
And one of the questions that I had was whether or not this was a bump or a ram. And it seems to me that both in Scott and here, even if you use the word ram, it was used in both connotations. So it doesn't affect that. But there is a difference because here you have to assume that there was a direct violation. You have to assume that there was a direct violation of a superior or officer's order. And if you look at Scott, the holding in Scott is the policy in Scott is that you have to stop this vehicle or other people will be in danger. Now, the situation here was that it was at, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Although they started in a neighborhood, they were outside. And if I recall this case, I think I was on the panel that had the municipal.
You were.
And they went one way, and supposedly he said he went the other way, and they met some, you know, down the river road or whatever it was. Then the question is, if there was, and we have to assume that there was a bump, did the danger of innocent people being affected by this high-speed chase, was that less or more? Should we take that as a prevalent consideration over the fact of the injury that occurred here or the stop that occurred here?
It's a fair question, and the answer to it is no. And the reason why is, as we talked about in our briefs pretty extensively, I think, was that the fact is that it puts an overwhelming and impossible burden on a police officer to be parsing through that level of detail as he's making split-second decisions regarding the life and death, as he's going 90 miles an hour down a road. And I think if you look at Scott, and if you hadn't taken a chance, it's instructive and helpful, I think, to go to the website and see the video of Scott. Scott V. Harris, like this case, took place at night. The chase took place at night. Now, it wasn't as late at night. I don't think all of the opinion's not very clear as to what time of night it was.
10 or 11 in this.
Yeah, because I know they were in a parking lot of a shopping center. The shopping center was closed. That started.
It's clear in that case that they were in neighborhoods. They were.
When it started. Now, that's what I'm saying. It's interesting to look at that video because by the time the maneuver was made that resulted in the injury, you can see no other cars, you can see no other houses. I don't know that it was in a rural area at the time, but they're not. There's nobody else around them. And I think the point is that you're putting an officer in a position to be making guesses. Is there somebody else up their head that's going to come up and be injured by this? And in addition to that, this road that they're on is a country, narrow, hilly, windy road that they're going 90 miles an hour down. It's got houses. It's not in the city, so you don't have zoning ordinances. You've got houses that are right up next to the road, churches, buildings, all these things that line this road. And it doesn't have to be just another car approaching them at that late hour of the night. They could be sitting in somebody's bedroom with a car through the wall for, you know, very easily given the speeds these guys were going and you know, the proximity of these houses to the road. So a lot of things could happen. Just because they're on a country road late at night does not, I think, make this materially different than Scott.
How about the rule of law in Scott? It says, instead we lay down a more sensible rule. A police officer's attempt to terminate a dangerous high-speed car chase that threatens the lives of innocent bystanders does not violate the Fourth Amendment. Innocent bystanders.
even when it places the fleeing motorist at risk of serious injury or death. And it, and to the extent, I mean, and this is kind of a calculus, you know, to the extent that there's a higher risk of lives of innocent bystanders being threatened, then you can make this type of seizure. But if the threat is less, you know, I don't know how to work that.
We've asked ourselves the same questions as we get prepared for this. And the thing is, as I say, if you go look at that video, it's just worth looking at, because at the time they make the maneuver, there is nobody around. There are no innocent bystanders. There's no cars or no people. And the court goes through and talks about that, you know, just the fact that somebody slows down, just the fact they're in an area where there's nothing going on at the moment, that doesn't lessen the risk. It, you know, there's not people maybe standing there, but they may be around the court.
But the officer doesn't know who's around the corner.
That's precisely my point.
He doesn't know who's on the other side of the hill coming up. And, you know, over the years, I've had some good friends killed by people driving on the wrong side of the road at night.
But I think the important thing is, and you locked onto it, and that is that a police officer simply does not know. And that has to be part of the calculus of judgment in this case.
What about it gives me a little concern. Doesn't seem to have been expressly raised by counsel opposite, but qualified immunity applies to officers exercising discretionary functions. If an officer has been told not to pursue, is he exercising a discretionary function when he pursues?
Well, I would take issue with the fact that it only applies when they're conducting a discretionary function. My recollection is the discretionary function, mandatory function dichotomy died back in the days when they first developed qualified immunity and got away from the sovereign immunity issues and the distinctions between a governmental officer and the government itself, and where they were making distinctions based on that, and then just went strictly to qualified immunity. And I don't believe it applies to just discretionary functions at this point. But nonetheless, even if it did, John, or my position on it would still be that violating either a direct order, a policy, a local ordinance, whatever might be the case, simply it might have create problems for the officer. Internally, it may create state law problems, but it does not have Fourth Amendment implications.
What you're saying is that we should focus on the acts of seizure and decide the Fourth Amendment issue solely on those acts without input from that he was violating an order.
Yes,
sir. That's what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Now, if that's the case, how... Is any violation of senior officer's order or of policy, would that per se not affect the Fourth Amendment analysis?
In my view, that's correct. It may have state law implications. There may be a cause of action that they can pursue under some other law, but not the Fourth Amendment. And I think the courts have been pretty clear about that.
Well, we certainly have held, I guess, that the Fourth Amendment, and maybe our laws just didn't all that, we haven't straightened it out all that much, but we have held, for example, that the fact that an officer, a state officer, arrests under a situation, and the Supreme Court recently held this too, I believe, in which state law didn't allow an arrest, does not constitute a fourth, but that doesn't, it doesn't constitute a Fourth Amendment violation. I don't know that those issues have been raised in qualified immunity context, but.
Well, it certainly have been raised in the substantive aspect of whether that's a Fourth Amendment violation, and you're exactly right. Courts have said that.
Sure have. I think Supreme Court held it too.
Yeah, they have, Your Honor. Sure
but one of the questions here is there a violation of constitutional right? That's the first question that has to be answered.
That's correct.
With a qualified immunity. Now, it may affect the second prong, whether it's reasonable or not. I don't know.
That's another thing that probably worries me here. And I think Judge Garza is entirely correct. You have to decide. I mean, you've got to first decide, was there a constitutional violation?
Correct.
But the prior panel in this case held that there was.
Well, no, sir, and that's a fair question, too. That's another thing.
Held that there was enough evidence to find one.
On the specific issue that was brought to it, and to make this make sense, you have to go back to the district judge's opinion and what the narrow issue was that he ruled in our favor on initially, which was only that there was not enough evidence to show intent. That's what the judge ruled in our favor on initially. And that was the only thing that the Fifth Circuit ruled on in the second PASCO appeal, was whether there was enough evidence of intent. We were really only arguing over sufficiency of evidence. And we never really got into substantive Fourth Amendment law, just enough for evidence of whether there was something to indicate that we had intended
to
hit him.
To hit him.
Yes, sir.
To either, yeah. Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Saylor. Mr. Wade.
I may please the court. Please. Of course, I have to comment to the court. I appreciate Mr. Seiler's conciliatory comments before we started. After reading the brief, I thought he was really mad at both me and Judge Aycock as well. So I was really glad to hear that. One thing he says in his brief, Your Honor, is that it seems like it just kind of reads like it blames me. Well, we didn't raise this earlier because of your litigation strategy or something like that. But what I want to point out to the court is there was no reason in the world that this immunity could not and should not have been raised before we had the first appeal. They filed their summary judgment motion and said, well, you can't prove your case. You don't have any evidence. Our only witness was deceased. We got to take the version of the officer as to how this happened, and that's what came down here. There was no reason in the world they couldn't have said that at the time. In addition to that, we have qualified immunity. There's no set of law. They could have done that.
Well, let's, Mr. Wade, the complaint, the first complaint, which was filed on June 27, the only thing that I can see here was that the body was found approximately 20 feet from the automobile in a location that would appear very difficult, if not impossible, for it to be thrown from the automobile. The officers claim that Pasco died from severe head injuries that resulted when he was thrown. There is no blood in the automobile, and the only blood that was found on the ground of the head, blah, 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 blah. And then this was the original complaint.
This was in the – is this the suit against the city that you read from?
Yeah, this is the 627-01.
That wouldn't be the one we're here on then, Your Honor.
No, that's right. Yeah. But it wasn't until April the 24th, that Mr. Knobloch was brought in, and the allegation of the that he hit the rear and knocking it off into the deep ravine. My question to you is that at any time prior to arguing before this court on the second appeal, did you raise in any type of pleading this that it was the ramming that you were focusing on and not that this person was beaten after the fact?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. It's in the original complaint that was filed in this case. It was also the subject of an evidentiary hearing where we called our expert.
I have that. The April 24th, 2003. Now tell me exactly where it's at there.
In the first place, it's in the complaint. I'll have to look in my brief and see if I don't have the copy of the complaint before me, but it's in there that he.
Here, Joe.
You ought to have a copy of the complaint.
I do have a copy of the complaint. Why don't you look at that? Just tell me what you're relying on. I'd like to know. You just leave it there on the desk. I'll pick it up later.
You want me to do it now?
Yes. Oh, you can. I'll tell you what. Why don't you take that with you, and then you can refer to it when you come back. Why don't you keep on with your argument, Mr. Wade? I don't want to take that much of your time. I just want to.
He doesn't have rebuttal, you know.
All right. Your Honor, the other point I was going to make is in the Supreme Court Scott case, the United States Supreme Court says that the qualified immunity must be made at the earliest possible time. We had an evidentiary hearing on it where our expert testified before the first appeal. It's argued in the briefs. There's never been any issue raised by them that they didn't have notice. They just said we had an alternative theory. They've never claimed they didn't have notice that we were making that contention at the time of the first appeal. At the time of the
first appeal in this case.
Yes, sir. They could have raised it before we ever came down here the first time. There was no need for them to wait till after this court had already remanded back to raise that issue.
Well, what you're saying is that before they took the appeal in this case, earlier appeal in this case, I'm forgetting the city case, is that?
Yes, sir.
But just this case, that they knew that you were claiming that he had rammed your car. That was the cause of his injury or whatever, his death.
Off the road, yes. So that was part of the district court ruling. That's why he dismissed it. He accepted their position. We had no proof, and our expert was not competent to testify to that. That's why they granted summary judgment the first time and we came down here. But in that first proceeding, he had never claimed qualified immunity. And the Supreme Court has said and repeatedly cited you have to raise qualified immunity at the earliest possible time. Whole purpose is to keep this piecemeal litigation here and be free from suit. But we come down, have an appeal, argue it, and then go back, and then we raise it.
No, that's their right. And I think their position is that they raised it at the earliest possible time when they knew that you were not claiming that he was beaten to death after the accident, but that it was in the ramming that the death occurred. Because, I mean, as I read that first complaint, I mean, it seems to indicate that it was impossible for him to have sustained his death and damages within the vehicle because there was no blood within the vehicle. And it just seems to me that's frivolous. If, you know, obviously there was a violation, and if given the allegations in that first complaint. But something changed in this. The theory seemed to have changed.
No, Your Honor, it never changed. We always said when I filed this first suit, I did it. Basically, I didn't know what had happened. I made the city only a defendant. I hated to make these serious allegations against the officer without checking into it. Sure. But we always maintained throughout this two theories. Either he was beaten to death or he was killed in the collision. But we always maintained that he bumped him off the road. Otherwise, they would have never filed their first motion to strike our expert who was making that point. He made both those points. The district judge sustained one. He said, you don't have enough evidence to show that he was beaten, and you also don't have enough evidence to show he bumped him off the road. We appeal down here. We only appeal that latter part. And then this court only addressed that latter part. We go back, and then that's when they say, well, we're relying on this Supreme Court case, and now we're going to raise qualified immunity. Your Honor, I'm afraid I'm going to waste my time and not get to the merits of it. Your Honor, here's the crucial difference between this case and what the United States Supreme Court has just decided and every other case that's interpreted that. In these cases, we have an officer that says, yes, there was a danger out on the highway. I bumped into the person and I ran him off the road because there was danger to the public. And in fact, in the United States Supreme Court case, the Scott v. Harris case, they documented that with a videotape. They had compelling evidence that that's what happened. The officer said, this guy's endangering the public. I've got to stop it. In this case, what we have is an officer saying, I wasn't even there. I had broken off the chase. I wasn't anywhere around. So there's nobody that has testified that there was danger to the public that justified me crashing into that vehicle. Justice Scalia said it's a case of balancing what is the governmental interest in promoting the public safety as against the individual's interest in his life.
But we do know, and you have alleged that there was a chase, that it was in a certain location, and at a certain time.
Yes, sir.
Now, you're right that nobody has testified, I guess, as to who the if there were any.
Nope.
Bystanders.
No, sir. Nobody said there's any danger. In fact, Judge Aycock is criticized by saying this is a gift. Why do we want to give this guy a gift or qualified immunity? Well, that's very appropriate in this case because what he is saying is I need qualified immunity because I am lying. I mean, I'm lying, and in fact, I want you to imagine that there was danger out there, and I, in fact, bumped this guy off the road because of the danger. That's a very unusual form of qualified immunity. Most times it's just some factual dispute, and you construe it in the light most favorable to them. But in this case, nobody has said there's danger going on, people are being endangered, and that's the reason I'm bumping him off the road.
Of course, I guess you say nobody knows how fast your client was going or anything like that, except at least at that time. What's the time differential that we're talking about and space differential? I say between the last time the defendant here, Mr. Officer, says, you know, I was following him and we were here and then I stopped, and then how far down the road is it?
I might say this. I don't feel like under the facts of this case the court has to take his testimony as being true in light of the Reeves. But assuming you're going to take his testimony, he was about a mile out of town when he stopped the chase, and the accident happened 2.5 miles out of town. Our expert says the speed was slow because he tracked down the highway. Had he been going fast, he would have vaulted off, and he followed his tracks and said he was going at a relatively slow rate of speed when he ran off the road. That's what our expert says at that time was going on. Your Honor, what he's saying, what counsel's just arguing the facts, arguing basically inferences from the facts, and he says, well, there's a whole bunch of houses along there. I never saw it in the record. Maybe he's got some site that there are houses along the road. I drove down from Tupelo. I don't know of any place you can go 2 miles and there's not houses down the road.
Is it hilly? Is it curvy? Is it a hilly? Is it a curvy road?
That's what the testimony was, yes, ma'am.
So how do you know what's coming around the corner?
Well, you don't, Your Honor. And if the officer had done this, if he'd come in, I think this would be an entirely different case. If he'd come in and said, I could see we were endangering the public, I saw people out in the yard at 3 in the morning, or I did something to endanger the public, and therefore I made the decision that I'm going to run this guy off the road, I think that this would be a case that the court could grant summary judgment on. I mean, uphold the summary judgment. But that's not what happened. If he had said that, he said I was nowhere around.
But you're asking him to lie. I'm saying his version is I never bumped him. You're saying, well, yes, you did, and you've got to ask him to fabricate. I mean, it's a And we're saying, even assuming all of your facts.
Yes, ma'am. What we have to do when
it's got to be an objective officer, doesn't
yes,
it?
Ma'am. If we go back to the jury, and the jury believes, in my opinion, they will be entitled to win. If the jury in fact believed, and he got up there and testified, that he bumped him off because he perceived some danger to the public, they'd be entitled to a directed verdict, probably, if he had any type of things to support it. But what our expert says, the guy was knocked off the road at a slow rate of speed. There's no evidence in the record of any danger at or about that time to anybody. And the only thing you can say is, well, the officer said he left the city going 90 miles an hour. Under these facts, I'm not sure you have to believe that, but the officer had also testified he played a game of hide and seek with this guy inside the town, and he didn't see enough evidence to stop him from DUI. A jury might think these guys are just two thugs out there together, not necessarily that this officer's out doing his job, because what's he doing in town just playing a game of hide and seek? And he says he knows who he is, he knows his name, he's got his tag number. And I don't think the jury has to decide that, well, we just assume that this officer was out trying to protect the public because he hadn't testified to that.
Mr. Wade, what is the summary judgment evidence if there's no eyewitnesses? I presume you have your expert.
Yes, we have our expert and the physical evidence that he testified to. He said, and the magistrate judge said, this is not really expert opinion. He and also the county coroner said that you can go to that area where the car is, and you can't look up from the highway where the car was found and see that. It's like 90 or 100 yards down the highway. Yeah. It's through brush and things, and it cannot be seen from the highway. And the officer says that I just happened to be driving by and I saw it.
Well,
and then there's a paint transfer from the what is apparently a scrape off of the back of the vehicle, which we had testimony that was not there the previous day. We had, in fact, another officer testify that he saw this police car in the repair bay.
Was there evidence that was the police officer's paint?
No, sir, just that there was a scrape mark. It's not.
Okay.
Your Honor, might I say this? Your Honor is in the first panel. I did not recall Your Honor was on it, but I just believe these issues have already been resolved with the first appeal.
My recollection was that they were going down this highway, and he took the, quote, the river road. And according to what I remember is that he came around and then when he came around and tried to see if he would meet him someplace else, that's where he found him. Not that he followed, but he came around the other way or something or other. We'll look at the record.
The only thing I can say is Your Honor has already ruled on court has already held that there was a fact issue about what happened in the case. That's in the second appeal.
What is his story? I'm confused. Now, I understand that he said that he stopped, you know, when the guy told him don't chase him and so forth. All right, and then how come is he out there? And you say, well, he said he saw him down Yes. And you couldn't see him, but how does he relate?
Yes, I should have made that clear, Your Honor. I'm sorry. Here's what the officer says happened. The officer says that he immediately obeyed the order to stop the chase. And then he turned around and headed back toward town, came back in his own direction. And then he ran up on another officer. And they stood there and had some discussion about what to do. And then he decided to turn back around and head back out of town. And he was driving out of town and got about 2.5 miles from town and looked off and saw, first he saw gravel on the side of the road, and then he looked down in the ravine and saw the car, which two witnesses have said he could not have seen. And he went down there and found the deceased. That's basically what he says. Your Honor, I've got one thing I should have raised in the briefs, and we didn't, but it is a jurisdictional matter. There's a case that we cited. I just cited in a letter to the court, but it's a recent application of the familiar principle that there can't be an issue of fact here or this court has no jurisdiction, basically. Well, Judge Aycock specifically found there were issues of fact in her opinions that's on the last page because there are genuine factual issues at issue here. That's what Judge Aycock said. This Sixth Circuit case that I just cited to Your Honor said that the court, at least in the Sixth Circuit, if the district judge says there's an issue of fact, there are, unless there's just some totally blatant, ridiculous error of Baxter, is what they said. Well, here's the issue of fact. Was there danger to the public at or about the time this happened? That's the issue of fact. Judge Aycock found there is an issue of fact. There are issues of material fact.
What issue did she find there? I don't understand quite what she said. She didn't think that.
She outlined.
She said there was an issue of fact whether there was a sufficient danger to the public.
In fairness, I didn't, Your Honor. She just outlined the facts from both sides. She didn't say that these are fact issues. She just said kind of conclusion with their issues of fact.
Well, I think we've held that where they don't tell us what they think is the issue of fact, we'll make them tell us.
All right. Well, in this case, Your Honor, I would just submit that it really cries out that the issue of fact is whether there was danger to the public. I mean, that's the issue of fact that's remaining in the case. And they failed to put on any evidence of that. I think we'd have an interesting argument if the officer said there's danger to the public and whether they'd have to accept that as true, but he hadn't said that, at least not at or about the time this happened.
I think that what we've held is not that we don't have appellate jurisdiction, is that we don't reverse the district court on a qualified immunity appeal if the district court, they've got the final word at this stage of the proceeding as to whether there's an issue of fact or not.
Yes, I just noticed in this,
we don't dismiss the appeal, I don't think, for lack of jurisdiction, but I don't.
Your Honor, this Landis case that I cited in the letter that I wrote you, what it says is that if the district judge says there's issues of fact, we accept it unless there's some showing of a blatant and demonstrable error in interpreting the facts by the district judge.
Is that the Sixth Circuit? Or
yes, it's a Sixth Circuit case. It's just October of 2008. It's an interpretation, of course, of all these cases saying there's no jurisdiction over factual issues on qualified immunity. That's the interpretation they give, and I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't know whether it's consistent with Your Honor's question or not.
Ms. Wade, when you go down, you look at that complaint and just kind of check.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay,
yes.
And then just when we conclude, just mark what you're relying on as
right.
or for your theory of the case.
All right, I'm looking at paragraph 4.
No, go ahead and sit down.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Let Mr. Seller have his turn. You are finished, I presume.
Yes, I was, Your Honor.
Good, thank you. Mr. Seller.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me just address a few points quickly. Unless you have questions. The waiver issue, which was the first thing that I believe you were discussing with Mr. Wade, it's instructive, I believe, when Mr. Wade indicates that the beating theory was not really part of his second lawsuit, to look at the brief that the plaintiff filed in support or in opposition to the defendant's motion for summary judgment. And I can tell you.
This case or the city case, which one?
This case.
This case.
This was after that second lawsuit was filed. If you look at it in the record, it's volume 4, pages 759 to 780. And although I could give you quotes right out of it, all through that brief, between pages 759 and page 779, in almost the entire brief, you can go through and pick out at least a dozen quotes where they're talking about the fact that the officer killed their decedent after
the accident after the decedent had exited the car. So any suggestion that the beating was still was not a factor in that second case is I believe, betrayed by what's in their brief.
What is the first paper indication that the theory had been changed?
The brief to this court in the first appeal in Pasco 2.
Okay. First appeal, Pasco 2.
Up to that point, you know, Mr. Wade, not a criticism, but just an observation, Mr. Wade's pleadings, complaints, as I said, we've been fighting each other off and on for over 25 years. I mean, notice pleadings, he takes that literally, and he doesn't put much in these complaints, and so we're left to guess frequently. And to respond to a question, rhetorical question he raised about why didn't we raise qualified immunity in the first motion, well, the first motion, frankly, was filed at their request to get the issue that the Fifth Circuit did not reach on the first on Pasco 1 to get review on that issue, which is what we did. And we had already won it once. We knew we were going to win it the second time. And the qualified immunity would have only gone to one of the two theories. So why in the world would we raise a separate defense on something that would only go to one of two theories of liability, wouldn't get rid of the entire case to start with?
Why did the court rely on Brar versus County of Inyo and Tennessee versus Gardner when they were specifically excluded in the Scott case? I mean, I don't understand that. I mean, at the very least, it seems to me that that would have that would not have been a good argument. I mean, this, as my law clerk said, anomalous.
Yeah, and frankly, we appeal this for only two reasons. This question being one of them, because we feel like, with all due respect to the district court, this has got to be addressed. This whole concept, which we talked about when I was first up, about there being a gift or a reward for good behavior, and I believe, Your Honor, the reason she went with that. The Tennessee versus Garner and Brower cases rather than Scott was because of the belief that the court had that by virtue of allegedly violating his supervising officer's instruction to cease the pursuit.
Okay, given that fact, then that triggered this.
That's the way I read the opinion.
At some point, maybe I have a different idea of the point, but at some point the danger has to reach a certain level or such that a reasonable person could assume it was dangerous. I mean, I don't think there's got to be people walking out in the middle of the street or anything like that. But if we want to assume that the plaintiff's decedent here, once he saw that your client had stopped the chase, it felt like it wasn't necessary to go very fast anymore, and of course, just drove along around 35 miles an hour. You can't come up and knock him off the road when he's doing that.
Well, if you presume that the decedent knew he had stopped the chase and had gone down to a low rate of speed, but
he didn't see me more or whatever. He saw him pull off to the line. I don't know, but if you don't have any, what is your? I mean, the district judge, according to Mr. Wade, is talking about, hey, there's a fact issue here about whether there's enough danger. Now, I agree with you entirely. If you're going 90 miles an hour on a curvy road, it's dangerous, period, hilly, curvy. But who says that this guy was going 90 miles an hour and weaving around?
All right. Let me make some quick responses because I know I'm out of time. Number one, we have no choice. We've got to assume all the facts in favor that they have them in the record to the extent that they've got facts that back this up. There is no evidence about speed other than what the officer says. They don't have any evidence.
But the officer doesn't say anything about the speed
at the time of the collision. I understand.
Or
that.
Even
because keep in mind, he says I wasn't there when
I understand
here. So he can't say anything about the speed. But we have to accept
somebody's got to say something about it.
Well, how can we if there's no evidence?
I thought his expert said there were. It was He was traveling a low rate of speed.
His expert says, and that's correct, that at the time of the collision, that he believes he was traveling at a low rate of speed.
If that's true, why isn't that a fact?
Well, Scott, it's not a fact. We'll accept that.
Fact question.
It's not. We'll accept it. We accept that he was traveling at a low rate of speed at the time of the alleged ramming. But Scott V. Harris talks about that, that just because somebody slows down at some point doesn't mean they're not going to speed up again. And just because, and again, it's instructive to look at that video in Scott V. Harris because there was nobody around him when they gassed. One of the reasons they rammed him when they did because they were in a place where there was nobody present. That doesn't mean that around the next corner you're not going to run into somebody or going to run into somebody's bedroom.
I understand all that, but you're not talking around the next corner. We're talking about a mile and a half and outside of the city, and it just seems to me that if the district judge here says there's a fact issue, it's not established what the context was at the time this ramming took place. We don't know. This guy may have been going, you know, for some period rather slowly.
True.
And isn't it your obligation? Well, it's not actually your obligation to a certain extent. That gets, once you plead it, the other side's got the
correct.
Got the burden on qualified
correct.
Immunity, but it seemed like you have to, if she says there's a fact issue, don't we have to look and see what?
Well, my view is how can there be a fact issue when we're willing to assume everything they say is true?
But you,
where's the fact issue?
But where is that? You say there's this mad chase along the highway of a guy who's speeding around going, I don't know what, 80 or miles an hour around a curvy road. Where is the evidence of that?
The officer's testimony.
He wasn't out there. The last mile and a half, he wasn't.
I understand. Out. And all we've got, and you're right, they've got the burden to prove that the qualified immunity defense doesn't apply, not that we don't have the burden to prove that it does. And the only thing they've got in the record to prove that what his speed was this expert witness who says he thinks that they were going slow. Well, we're willing to accept that. He was going slow at the time of this alleged ramming. Scott V. Harris ends this inquiry. The court and Scott V. Harris balanced all this out and said, here's the situation. When an officer's chasing somebody in a dangerous high-speed chase, It's not a Fourth Amendment violation. It doesn't matter
chase,
if he slows down.
We don't know there's any dangerous high-speed pace. That's the thing that worries me.
There was before the ramming because there's no evidence to the contrary.
I think we got your case. Thank you very much, Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Wade, if you would give me that back to me and just.
Mr. Honor, four and six.
You got it. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.